Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. A theory of human migration based on an examination of the Y chromosome carried by males tells us that people crossed the landmass that once connected Siberia to Alaska. Some of these people continued walking south and many generations later settled on the western edge of the Amazon basin in South America in what is now eastern Peru. One of these groups is called Shipibo. Prior to 1950, the Shipibo had no written language. At that time, Christian missionaries created a written standard to translate their Bible. Menenima Hilario was born Shipibo into his tribe, which lived in the traditional Stone Age fashion in the Peruvian jungle. He lived there until he was 11 years old. At age 11, he went to the secondary school in the Hispanic Amazon town of Pucallpa, Peru. Later, from Lima, Peru, he found his way to Taylor, Texas, and then on to Sonoma State University in Northern California, where he graduated in June of 1997. In this interview, originally broadcast in January of 1997, I spoke with Menenima Hilario in his home in Petaluma, California, when he was 26 years old, and asked him what his life was like as a child in the jungles of eastern Peru. Since that interview, Menenima Hilario has enrolled in Stanford University to work towards his PhD.
I mean, as I look back my life, you know, having all the comforts and all the luxuries here, you know, is really different. For instance, we didn't have a bed, you know. For instance, our house is made of the palm leaves, you know, and we don't have any walls at all, and our floor is really high, so we don't have like a bed as we know it here. You know, we just basically sleep on the floor.
What was the floor made from?
It's made of the special what do we call it, tawas. It's like a really, it's not really hard, but kind of soft, you know, wood that we, you know, put in as our floor. Mm-hmm. But the activities that we do daily was mainly like, for instance, very early in the morning, my grandfather used to, you know, wake me up like around 5 in the morning or so, and it was time to go fishing, you know, so I used to, you know, get ready to go fishing with my grandfather.
How old were you?
I was like around, I remember clear, like around 7. I was a little boy, you know, and mm-hmm. That was really a routine for me. So my grandfather was teaching me to, you know, how to be a strong man, you know, and preparing me to be a strong man. So I used to go with him, and I was just like really lazy like any other kid, you know. But I had to do it because that was a part of skill that I had to have in order to survive in the jungle, you know. Mm-hmm. So
is food readily available?
As far as the food is concerned, we have to hunt or fish every day in order to live there.
But there's enough to be able to find and eat.
It used to be, but not right now because of the massive deforestation. A lot of fishing companies going into our rivers and our lakes. You know, they're massively, you know, fishing the fish there. So for us, it used to be really easy to go fish, say, you know, catfish or, you know, piranha or different kind of fish, I mean, to live. But right now, in order to bring enough food for the family, you have to stay there like almost all day, you know, to catch like maybe 20 fish or so. And compared to that used to be like, you know, just used to go for a few hours to fish, you know, catch some fish, you know. So it's become really, I mean, scarce right now.
How far from your village would you be able to go as a young boy? Out into the jungle?
Like when I was around, I remember 10 years old approximately, I was able to go by myself like one day canoe trip would be. So that was pretty much, you know, my limit.
Did somebody teach you the orientation or the secrets of the jungle so that you would mm-hmm. not get lost?
Yeah, exactly. My grandfather especially was like the master, you know, in if you get lost in the jungle, how to survive that, different kind of, if you find, poisonous snake or jaguars or tigers, how to,
What did he tell you?
For instance, if you get attacked by boa constrictor, for instance, because how the boa attacks is, they kind of wrap you around really
right.
quick, so as soon as you realize that, you are wrapped by the boa constrictor, you're supposed to bite the snake, because he used to say that our teeth has some kind of poisonous, stuff, so that immediately after you bite, bite several times to the boa, then it will unwrap you, because our teeth has some kind of poisonous, he used to say.
You think that's true?
It's hard to prove it since I was never attacked by boa.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What kind of animals and little creatures that live in the jungle did you see and either have as friends or capture to eat?
One of the animals that we used to capture was the little wild pigs and squirrels. When I was, around 10 years old, with all my, friends, we used to also make some competition, whoever, kills more squirrels were, like the macho guy, whoever, killed more poisonous snakes were, the best hunter or something like that, So as far as, pets, we didn't have too much pets. We had, in a village, there were, around, 4 to 5, and pet animals, such as like little monkeys and wild pigs.
Mm-hmm. You've told me that your name, Manenima, mm-hmm. means one who travels.
That's right. Yeah.
How did you get that name?
Yeah, what happened is, before the missionaries came, we didn't have any kind of calendars or any kind of knowledge as far as the dates and as far as, the year is concerned. So when a woman were pregnant, they didn't know when they were due, so they could do anything, travel, anywhere they wanted. So one day my parents were traveling, from one village to another, and suddenly my mom started having the pains, and then she gave a birth in the canoe. And little baby was me,
uh-huh.
So actually I was born in a canoe, and that's why my parents called me El Viajero in Spanish, but the Shipibo would be Manenima.
Mm-hmm.
Or Manere non tinkai, which means, Manenima is traveling on a canoe or something like that. Yeah.
And then you told me that your mother said you were always very curious as a child.
Yeah. My grandfather, especially my mom, a couple years ago when I was talking to my mom, I asked her, what was I like when I was growing up? And she told me that I was really different than other boys, in the village. I was, for instance, and the missionaries have brought a lot of magazines to our village. So I used to go grab those magazines, when I used to go fishing by myself. I used to, I get my, my fishing poles and grab my, couple magazines, when I was fishing. So what I used to do was that, while I was fishing, I was looking at the magazines, which was, I believe, was National Geographic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the, how I found a picture of New York skyline, one of the tall buildings there. So that was like the turning point of my life.
How old were you?
I was 11 and a half, or 12 years old,
yeah.
Approximately. Yeah.
What did you think when you saw these buildings and the people in New York?
It was like, for instance, like if you have, your sunglasses, and it's kind of dark. Your world is limited, to what you see. But it was something like I had awakened for a long trip. For a long dream, So it was something like a. Like an awakening time for me, because before that my life was just limited to fishing and killing monkeys and squirrels and stuff, so that was life for me. But when I saw this, I said, look, there's a different world, here, and I would like to go there to get training, to help my people.
Did you have support or enthusiasm from your mother and father when you told them you wanted to go?
First of all, because I'm the only boy in the family, my mom was really sad, because as I was her only boy, I was the guy who was going to provide the food for her,
yes.
Fishing, hunting and stuff. So in those terms, my mom was really sad, But I also told her that, you know, because our people were suffering a lot of injustice from outsiders, you know, I told her that I would like to go to his place so I can get training to help my people, you know, from this injustice. So and from that point of view, my mom was happy, you know, that.
What kind of injustices did you see being mm-hmm. placed upon your people when you were 10 and 11?
For instance, when I was really, I knew, you know, what was wrong, what was right. For instance, although I didn't had a formal training into as far as exploitation is concerned, but I had an idea what was that all about. For instance, my grandfather was working for this patron, you know, a Hispanic guy, and he was, you know, working for him like for almost 1 month. In exchange of the work that he provided for this patron, he only got like one machete and a couple of clothing.
How often?
Just for 1 month, that was it, one machete and a couple of clothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I knew that there was something wrong with it. So, and I was really angry by that, you know, because I knew that that somehow that was not fair, you know, for the people to treat us that way, you know. Also, we also felt that we were established Indians, you know, we were like second-class citizens, you know, because they treat us, that way how they, you know, how they dealt with us. So,
I want to take a moment and say that I'm talking with Maninima Hilario in his home in Sonoma County, California, about his childhood as a member of the Shipibo tribe of Indians who live near Pucallpa in Peru in the Amazon Basin. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Maninima, when you were growing up, you've described to me now that when you were growing up, that your tribe was like a Stone Age tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how its life was, if you would, as a Stone Age tribe. The things that we take it granted so much sitting here in your home, mm-hmm. we take for granted so much, that are just non-existent.
I mean, that's a interesting question because, I mean, as I'm living here in the United States, one of the industrialized nations, you know, when I compare my life, you know, growing up in the jungle where we don't have any electricity, no running water, you know, fast food restaurants, no anything at all, you know, where if you're hungry, you know, you have to grab your fishing poles and go, you know, fishing, or, you know, grab your bow and arrows and go hunting if you want to eat something, you know. But here, you know, if you're hungry, you just, you know, go to fast food restaurant here, I mean, Taco Bells or, you know, hamburgers. So, there's so much food here, you know, there's so much things, I mean, so many, many things here that the people just don't take advantage of that.
They just eat here, whereas there you had to go get it.
Exactly. Yeah, here, you know, for a couple bucks, you just get your hamburgers, you know, but there, in order to grab, say, you know, a dozen of fish, you have to be there almost a day, you know, and to provide for yourself and for your family, you know, so.
With no electricity, was there artificial lighting after dark?
No, at all. We had, as far as, you know, lighting, we had, we used to use the grease of the manatees. You know, after we kill the manatees, you know, we eat it, mm-hmm. and then we save the grease.
That's a large fish, looks like it's flying, but
yeah,
it's in the water.
Exactly. So that's really big fish, you know, that could provide for the food for the whole family for a month or so. So we used to use the grease as oil to have a little lamp. So that was like the one artificial light at night, you know.
Did people generally go to sleep at darkness and get up at dawn?
Exactly. Yeah, like we go to sleep like around 8 or so, you know, because like around 6 o'clock it's already really dark. So after, you know, after that, you know, you go to see your the elder of the village, you know, to get advice and, you know, to get stories from that person. And after that, you just go to bed. Yeah.
Without a calendar, and you were talking about how your mother wasn't sure when you would be born,
mm-hmm.
except when she felt the pains of
That's
labor.
Right.
Without a calendar, was there any kind of reference to holidays or festivals that would occur on a and with a certain frequency?
You know, unlike other tribes or other indigenous group, I mean, my tribe specifically, we don't have like a specific date where we celebrate, but we have celebrations. For instance, when somebody is successfully hunting, you know, then that person has to cook the food for the whole village. So on. So those are primarily, and also we have a big ceremony is when a boy is turning into a young man, also when a girl is turning into a young woman. So we have some celebrations, you know, to recognize, you know, those people.
The rites of puberty.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is there any particular training that young people receive prior to puberty?
Yeah. Like for instance, usually, you know, the father or the dad or the grandfather, you know, or sometimes combined dad and grandfather, you know, take you like for a week or sometimes a month, you know, to go hunting. You know, they teach you how to, I mean, survive if you get lost in the jungle when you're hunting, you know. Then basically, that's like the boot camp, I would say, you know, here in those terms. Basically, your parents take you there, I mean, to this really, really heavy jungle. Then you have to, I mean, you as a young man have to bring your parents back to home. So that's mm-hmm. the task. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about for the girls?
For the girls, they mainly have to be able to make potteries, you know, painting, cloth, weaving, and cooking, and different things, you know, to have skills that a tribe requires in order to be recognized as a young woman.
Is there separation of the boys and girls during childhood in where they live or where they play?
Actually, no. There's no separation at all as far as only in the time of doing the work. Is, you know, for instance, the boys, you know, go to go fishing and hunting with their parents while the girls stay, you know. But as far as like the playing time and stuff, you know, they just play together.
How about in background education towards sex and reproduction?
Here there's no sex education, you know, there. It just, for instance, when a guy is like around 16, you know, then that person's able to survive, and the girl is maybe probably the same age, then, you know, she's able to cook and everything. Then what happens is there's arranged marriage. So and if you have those qualities, you know, then you are a good candidate to get married, you know. Otherwise, you know, you can wait for a long time to get married, yeah.
Is there any opportunity for the young people to protest an arranged marriage, or is that not within the kin?
Actually, what they can do is, you know, if they don't want to get married to a lady for any reason, you know, then they just can leave the village. They can leave the village for a year or two, then come back, you know. That's a sign of saying they don't want to marry her, or vice versa, you know, for a girl, too.
Does that carry any kind of a stigma?
No, at all. It's something that the people accept. You know, it's like, it's not a big deal. He just, you know, left the village and, you know, saying that he doesn't want to, you know, get married. Yeah.
Could you describe for us the geographical range of where the Shipibo people live along the western edge of the Amazon basin?
My tribe is located along the Ukiah River, which is the main one of the tributaries of the Amazon River, and we have approximately 300 villages, you know. And Pucallpa, you know, the Hispanic town, is the center, you know. We have the Alto Ukiah and the Bajo Ukiah, which is in the upper river and the down river. So all the villages are located along those along the river, the Ukiah River.
And each village or pueblito is of how many people?
Approximately, the smallest village would be like 100, 150 people. But the largest one is like around 1,500. And there are like three villages, you know, I mean, which have the same, that kind of population.
What's the reaction of your mother and father of you moving so far away?
You know, they are really saddened by it, you know, because they cannot see me, you know, as often as they would like to, because, I mean, the Shipibo villages are really united. You know, they provided, I mean, each other economically, I mean, in different areas. So, for instance, the whole village is made up of, like, five families, so they're really close to each other. So for me to leave my village, it's really sad for me and for my parents too, you know. So, but they understand that I'm here not just to get my own benefits, you know, but I'm here to get a training, I mean, to help them survive in the 21st century.
What are your plans?
My plans is to graduate from the Sonoma State University, and to, as soon as I get my degree, you know, I want to start working. Right now I'm already working, but I want to work full-time, you know, to help my people, to assist them, you know, legally, environmentally, and socioeconomically, you know, to so they can have a good foundation to survive the 21st century.
Are you looking towards survival in the traditional ways, the ways you grew up as a mm-hmm. young boy, mm-hmm. or bringing into it the advent of electricity and paved roads and cars?
As far as surviving those ways, no, because I don't think that that would be a good thing to do in my village, you know. But when I'm talking about surviving in the 21st century, I'm talking about giving the skills that the Indians need in order to survive. For instance, the skill of to read and write, you know, the skills to be a better farmer, you know, the skills to say, for instance, to deal with the village and to deforest, you know, to cut the wood there. So I'm giving some kind of limited technology, you know, to be self-sufficient, you know, to live there.
Tell me about the deforestation in your village. Is it nearby? Is it threatening?
Yeah, we say it's really nearby and really threatening because, for instance, 2 years ago when I was doing a project there in my village, and there were like a couple of tractors, you know, who were, they were actually, you know, extracting the woods from our area. What happened was that there was one logging company that went to talk to the elders in the village, and they said, look, we'll give you $5,000, you know, and let us cut the wood. So as the Indians, I mean, never had so much money, they were really excited about it, you know, so and they said, yeah, go ahead. So basically, the Indians got the money, and this company was, you know, extracting the wood from our land, from our territory, as much as they like, you know. So when, when I was growing up there, I didn't even know what tractor was, but here it was in my village, you know, park and stuff now.
Is there any assistance for the Shipibo people from the Peruvian government?
As far as assisting educationally, yes, you know, because the Ministry of Education of Peru is supporting, you know, financially to the bilingual teachers, you know, who are trained by the missionaries there. So, and but as far as assisting other ways, no. Mm-hmm.
Well, as I understand it, the state religion of Peru is Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
But that wouldn't necessarily be the religion of the Shipibo people.
No, at all. Even though, at one point in time there was an attempt to try to convert the Indians to be Catholics, you know, but they had a strong resistance to that. You know, a lot of Roman Catholic missionaries were killed, you know, by Shipibo Indians and by other tribes too. So on a, so we don't have a lot of Catholic churches in our tribe, you know, but our tribe don't necessarily, I mean, my tribe doesn't necessarily have a religion, but they, because of the influence of the missionaries, you know, most of them believe in God.
Mm-hmm. Is there a concept of God in the Shipibo?
Yeah, there was an idea of God, and because of the Inca influence in our tribe, you know, my grandfather used to say that that our creator was the God Sun, you know, because the sun was always providing with the light, and, you know, providing us with some kind of a provision, you know, for subsistence and different kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Is there a concept of afterlife? In other words, when someone dies, where they might go?
Yeah, there's a really deep concept, which is that that we have to be a good people. That means that you have to provide a good service to your neighbor, I mean, to the whole village, you know. because that means that if you have that kind of life, and when you die, then you will not be thirsty, because the concept about dying is that after you die, you know, you are so thirsty, you know, so, and that you will suffer forever, you know. But if you're good people, then you are kind of investing in your water after life. Yeah.
Is there any kind of concept that of soul being reborn in another person?
We don't have that belief, but we believe that after you die, I mean, your soul or whatever, you know, you want to call it, is fly in the, I mean, in the spiritual world, traveling.
Anenimae Ilario, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. Mm-hmm. But before we close, I want to ask you the question I ask all of my guests mm-hmm. at the end of an interview. And that is, could you tell us of an interesting book that you've run across?
You know, one of the most amazing books that I just finished reading is the biography of General Colin Powell. He's one of the one of the smartest person that I ever, you know, seen in the TV or read his book, you know, and it's something that I checked in his book was that his birthday is April 5th, and according to missionaries, I was born April 5th, you know, so it's something that we share in common. So, and his book has influenced me greatly, you know, to get that energy, you know, from God, and to work hard, I mean, to accomplish things, you know, to sacrifice, to accomplish things, you know, so that's my goal, you know, to accomplish things in my life in order to help my people.
Anenimae Ilario, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Anenimae Ilario was born Shipibo into a traditional Stone Age tribe that still lives in the jungles of eastern Peru. The book that he recommends is the biography of General Colin Powell. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.